Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I got about 15 years and a little bit of experience in this program. And for the first 5 years, that's all I wanted to do was steps 1, 2, and 3. I didn't want to do none of the rest of this. So I should have a pretty good working knowledge of it. But you can believe that whatever comes out of here is not rehearsed today. I managed to share last night at a step 1 table at the Alcatan. And powerlessness to me was pretty well defined before I ever got to this program. I was 17 years old, sitting in a jail cell, a maximum security cell, with nothing to read but the Bible for 78 days. And I read it. There was nothing else to do. I read it through once, completely, and halfway through the second time. And I can't tell you where they're at today, but there was two verses that struck terror in my heart. One verse said, without God, there is no strength. And the other one said, be assured that a drunkard shall not find the kingdom of God. And that told me that if I died drunk, there was no hope for me. I knew I was weak. I knew I was godless. I knew I was powerless. And I knew I would drink again just as soon as I got out of the lockup. And I did for another 16 years. The funny thing was, I came to AA and they told me the same thing. Without God, there's no strength. Die drunk, there's no hope. And for me, that was the first step. I didn't have any problem paying lip service to the fact that I was an alcoholic and that I was powerless. Accepting it real down deep in my guts where I had to live with it was another story. But the concept of going back to worse than it had been before, the progression of the disease, is what convinced me that I had damn well better. And so I did. I just plain accepted the fact that I was powerless over people, places, and things, and I'm standing here this morning and proving it. Step 2, for me, was a little different. In the first place, I read that step and I thought, well, you people had your nerve. Because it seemed to me that what you were telling me in that step was that you thought I was nuts. That last phrase about restoring us to sanity, that we could be restored to sanity. To me, that just assumed that you folks thought I was crazy and that I needed help. Hell, I didn't need no help. I was doing just fine out there. I didn't know how much help I needed. I didn't have any concept of what insanity was until I put the plug in the jug for a few weeks. Things really got crazy after that. I'm sure a lot of you can identify with that one. But I had a concept of God. And as screwed up as it was, there were some things that I had experienced on a gut level about God that I knew to be true for me. And so, but God's complexion changed with some experience in this program. I was brought up by a good Southern Baptist mother and a drunken father, and I don't know which one made me crazier. I think my Southern Baptist mother made me crazier. All that guilt, man. I was going to go to hell for everything I enjoyed. He was keeping score. I experienced the same kind of spiritual experience of God that Bill Wilson described in a big book at age 11. The white light experience, the extreme peace that overwhelmed me just for a few moments. And I knew there was a God. And I knew He loved me, and I knew He cared about me, and that everything was going to be all right. And then them church people started on me. I knew in my guts at 11 years old that what they were telling me was a bunch of hooey. They were peddling guilt. And I was buying, and I didn't want to buy. Something was wrong there between what I experienced and what they were trying to teach me. And I couldn't tell you what it was. I just knew in my gut that it wasn't right and it wasn't true. So I picked up my first drink at age 13. And this is what God's all about. That was God from then on. That bottle and me. Only something still didn't quite jibe. That was power. Because I could run and hide from anything and everything that I didn't like or didn't want to feel, experience, or whatever. I could just... Hell, I could even talk to the girls when I wanted to with a drink. Dance with them. Chase them, catch them sometimes. And not feel too bad about it. I say too bad because that good old Southern Baptist guilt was still there. So I didn't have any problem with God Himself, but His complexion sure changed when I got to AA. I didn't like Him much before I got here. Because he was a scorekeeping SOB. But you guys talked about God as we understand Him. The heck of it was, I always had to sneak in. Whenever you people said we, and you said it in every step, whenever you said we, somehow I had to sneak and hunch you were leaving me out. You weren't including me. Because I had gotten to be a very un-person before I got to AA. Unwelcome, undesirable, unwanted. Never invited back to the same place twice. And all you guys did was said, hey, come on back. You not only shook my hand, you hugged me. Boy, that was a bad one. That first hug. What's this guy want? You know. So it took me a while to come to terms with the insanity that was being referred to in that second step. For a long time, I thought that my attitude about going to jail so much, I averaged 3 times a year for 20 years. 60 times. I never did total up the time, I'm afraid to. The guy said on the podium one day he was doing life on an installment plan, and I knew what he was talking about. I thought that my attitude about going to jail was a little flaky. Like it was all some kind of an adventure or a lark. You know, all good boys go to jail a couple times, just getting into mischief. They didn't go to jail like I did, though. Time after time after time after time. For the same things. And always as a result of drinking. Never once for something I did stone cold sober. Hope somebody's got the timer on me because I don't know what I'm doing up here. My ideas about what insanity was took a sharp turn one day Somebody at the table looked me dead in the eye, and he said, George, he said, you've been giving the definition of what insanity is for 4 years. I said, what's that? He said, you keep saying, I keep making the same mistakes. He said, George, that's nuts. I thought, well, damn. If everybody else has even a slight problem telling the difference between fantasy and reality, I guess I can have a little more problem and be just a little more nuts than the average Joe. But the important thing for me to get a hold of was the idea that everybody around here was at least a little bit nuts. And it was okay for me to be nuts, too. And he said, besides that, George, he said, don't put too much weight on the fact that it says could be restored to sanity. It said, it doesn't say that he's gonna restore you to sanity, George. I said, you mean I might stay nuts all my life? He said, yeah. That made it a little easier to take. It wasn't such a bitter pill to swallow then, because I could be at least a little bit like everybody else. The third step for me came down to a pretty simple matter when I finally got comfortable enough to look at it. Because it was pointed out to me that the key was to make a decision. The heck of it was that I didn't like the way it was written. And I didn't get caught up in it until one day a fella asked me to read the steps at a meeting, and I recited them, showing off. And a fella from Lum, Michigan, a little teeny tiny town that's not even on the map, east of Lapeer. His name was Leon. Leon from Lum. He said, that's pretty good, George. And then he handed me that little white card. He said, now read them. I read them. He said, now recite them again. And I did. He says, well, that's a pretty good job, George, but you didn't get it perfect. He says, if you believe that those steps are written the way you recite them, you've got them all wrong. He said, you're leaving out three words. In step three and one in step 11. I said, I am? He said, yeah. You're leaving out the care of in the third step. He said, that completely changes the whole step. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God as we understood Him. God don't want your will back, George. He doesn't want your life back, George. He wants to take care of your will and your life. I was trying to do something that was utterly impossible, and God didn't want nothing to do with it in the first doggone place. Free will is part of what makes me a human being. I have the freedom of choice. AA gave me that. God don't want to take that away from me. Any more than God will knock my next drink out of my hand. He's not going to do it, folks. He's just not going to do it. I can choose to do that. Today I choose not to. He said, the other word you're leaving out is the word only in step 11. He said, that gives you permission to pray for any damn thing you want to, George, in any fashion that you want to. And I had to stop and think about it, and he was right on. That's exactly what I was doing. I'm surprised that I didn't. I think he's back there shutting me up. So much for rehearsals. Thanks for listening to me and bearing with me on these. It's impromptu as hell, but I enjoy all these steps, folks, and those first three kept me alive and kicking when I want to do everything but. Thank you.
Thank you, George. I obviously can't speak for anybody else, but I still think you're nuts. Steps 4, 5, and 6, please welcome Ross H. from Ypsilanti.
Thanks. I am a drunk, and my name's Ross.
Hi, Ross.
And I'll be better than George because I have rehearsed. Most people, I'm from Jackson, moved to Ypsilanti, now I live in Ann Arbor. And in the beginning part of my sobriety, I didn't want anything at all to do with God. So I told everybody, got right in inventory. You know, I skipped over 2 and 3. So where I come from, I was one of the guys that was beating on the table, you got to take a 4-step. Well, one day, a couple of guys that are smarter than I am in AA, they're called sponsors, said, they're having a Saturday morning big book study out of the penitentiary. Why don't you come out and help them lead it? And so I got the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went running out to 4000 Cooper Street. I was going to show them boys how to write an inventory. Well, ladies and gentlemen, before you go into a penitentiary where they have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to read, you should at least read the literature. And a couple hours later, I walked out of there with a big book between my legs. like a little dog. And I don't preach as much about doing it anymore. As I study about alcoholism and myself, you know, alcoholics are incapable of accurate self-assessment. And boy, there's no truer statement ever said when I read that. And as I think it's in the Good Timers or one of the books. But if you was to leave me to inventory and to take care of myself, I'd be a mess. But the thing that I'd like to get across about the 4-step is that it's a fearless inventory. And I don't know of anybody in this room who has drunkenly done something that to get today can undo it. So the first thing we got to remember is the stuff that we're going to inventory has already been done. If you can't remember, ask your Ellen on Copart. You know.
They never
forget. I don't slam Ellen on a lot. But, I have a lot of fun with them. In my inventory, I found out that if I died, I'd like to come back as an Al-Anon member because they can drink and go to meetings. But, as any normal alcoholic, I'm looking for any way to drink. You know, that's what I'm comfortable at. But, To keep the inventory on a light note, you have to remember that it's fearless. You've already done what you're going to inventory. Now what we want you to do is we want you to write it down on paper. So as, like George said, you only have 3 things wrong. You just have done them 6,000 times apiece. You know? And that's insane, you know? This, I'm not bragging, but I've been married 5 times. Do you think I should inventory that?
Are you getting any better?
Nowadays when people meet me, before they say hello, they say, are you married or divorced? But, you know, it's getting better. I'm still trying. But you know, as I worked through all of these relationships and different things, I found out a lot. Is first of all, I was incapable of loving or having a relationship prior to AA, and all of the love and the wonderful things that I've had since Alcoholics Anonymous are because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And another thing about the inventory, in my opinion, and I get to say that because they asked me to be on this panel. This is not AA's opinion, by the way. It's my opinion. You have to read the book and find out what AA says. This is just my opinion of it. And that's something that's real, that you should really catch on to quick. You know, you got an old-timer, a bleeding deacon like Ross sitting around the table, and you really think he's got his shit together. Well, go read the book and find out. You know? Man, he sounds good. Well, how's he living? Whoops. You know. I'll never forget a counselor one time told me, he says, your program ain't worth a shit. You're getting divorced. Again. A couple years later, he went through a divorce. I was the first one to his office. Your program must not be worth a shit. Gene don't live in our town anymore. But yeah, so you have to be careful what you say, as I learned when I went to the penitentiary to tell them residents how to stay sober. You know, I've learned more from the residents in Southern Michigan prison than I ever learned from Ross or from being drunk. A lot of the inventory stuff includes a lot of, are you tolerant or intolerant? Are you patient or impatient? You know, they always have you balance the scale against good and bad. Well, that's fine, but we're not trying to change your natural instincts. Everybody has natural instincts. The fourth step asks you to inventory, you know, just so we don't get in an argument, it says, let's inventory, you know, pride, greed, lust, them, you know, the seven deadly sins. All of that stuff, John P., who spoke last night, has been sober 40-some years. I'll bet you, even if he's in the audience, I don't see him. I had breakfast with him. But I'll bet you a dime to a donut that he still has problems with impatience or intolerance or that stuff from time to time. You know? That's not what you inventory. You know? That stuff is just part of the human condition. You're always going to have it. What we need to inventory is our insane thinking. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings or anything, but I happened to be sitting next to a wonderful lady this morning who said she smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and she went to thinner cigarettes so she could only, you know, and she still could smoke the 3 packs a day. And I said, are you alcoholic by any chance? Boy, isn't that how we think? You know, we rationalize everything. We, you know, and I just love being around people that I can identify with. You know, well. But just remember that the written inventory is a must. You know, I like these people say there's no must in the big book. There's 117 of them. The little red book, which is not conference approved, but I like, has a chapter, if you go to all the way to the back, you open it up, it says, you don't have to, but, and then it lists the musts. And another thing about the inventory, it's a lifetime practice. I mean, I still go to a men's retreat once a year to inventory what happened from July to July. You know, to see if there's something that I can change. And I don't do it for my wife or my employer or anybody like that. I do it because I want to live better in sobriety. You know, these steps, in my opinion, really, really help me with the selfishness that I suffer from. And I'm not as selfish when I get some of my character defects and things under control. But after I get it listed down, then I have to go, in my opinion again, to the most important step in the program. And the reason that I think step 5 is the most important is it's the only place that I've read where it says invariably they got drunk. That's a key word for me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I'm trying to avoid at all costs. And it says in there, it doesn't matter if they've been sober 15 and 16 years like George and I, or 2 or 3 years, or 33 years. Invariably, they got drunk. Invariably. Ask old-timers why they drank after all this time, and they all said, I skimped on the inventory. A lot of people think, well, I can do it in my mind. Can you imagine what the mind of an alcoholic is? I mean, we got this perfectly normal thing called the brain. And then for 1 month to 30-some years, we fill it full of alcohol, drugs, and negative thoughts, and then we want to do an inventory with our mind? Well, I hate to tell you this. I don't want inventory anything with my mind. I found out when I first come to AA, they knew me real well. They said, you got two problems. AA will take care of one, old age will take care of the other. So when these people come in and talk about cross-addicted, I say, you don't even know what it means. They think because they use alcohol and drugs, they're cross-addicted. read a little farther. That's the same thing. But in step five, we have to do the thing that I'm not very good at, and that's ego deflation. I'm one of these guys that pump up a lot. And back in the beginning, remember I told you I didn't like God too well? And these sponsors again, there's too many women here to tell you what I call my sponsor. Blanken sponsor. Figure it out. And he said, Ross, he said, this is back in 75. He said, you want to do something in the state conference? I said, yeah, man, I'd love to. He said, okay, you'll be on a prison panel. Well, I've never been in prison. So we get ready to drive over to meet Harlan. Harlan had brought all the prisoners, and Jim and I and some of the other guys were driving over to the book Cadillac. And halfway there from Jackson, Jim threw a thing back to me that showed what I was going to do on the prison panel. It says, Ross H. from Jackson will give the invocation. And I said, what's an invocation? He says, it's the opening prayer. I said, shit, I'll pray. Huh? And you could have heard me call him a name all the way back to Jackson. And that night, before I was supposed to talk the next day, I'd run into Harlan, and I said to Harlan, I said, God, say a prayer for me. I'm giving the invocation tomorrow. And he said, say a prayer yourself. He likes to hear from strangers. So the sponsors knew me real well. And they knew that once I went into the book Cadillac and I seen that my name was going to be on the list, that I wouldn't back out. And they knew that I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And they knew that I would try to pray. So as humbly as I could that day, I come up and I said, Lord, please teach us how to laugh, but don't let us forget we cried. And I went and sat down and listened to five residents of Southern Michigan prison take my inventory. But I'd never been there, so I was better than they were. I should have been there. If you ever get to meet the judge, you'll find out why I wasn't there. I was just lucky. But you know, in the fifth step, all of these damned up emotions that we have are going to start coming forward. I can't talk about anybody other than myself, but when I drank, I suppressed a lot of things, acted differently than I felt, you know, and believe it or not, was ashamed and embarrassed of a lot of things. You know, that's why they invented blackouts for alcoholics. You know, Jesus, you know, can you imagine what we'd be like without blackouts? You know, we'd have to remember all that stuff we done. But in that regard, that's why I sort of like Al-Anon. They have to put up with remembering all of it, you know. But all of this stuff comes rushing forward when I start taking the fifth step. And the healing starts. And finally, I'll never forget when I read Jim my first inventory, I got down to one paragraph. I couldn't read it. I got all swelled up in the throat. I think nowadays they call it anxiety attacks. I thought I was just going to die. And I couldn't talk about it. And I couldn't talk about it. And finally, Jim says, "Are you done?" And I said, "No, I got to read this." So anyway, I read it to him. And all of my secrets were gone. I'd finally told somebody everything. And I started to get peace. Last year, about 3 months ago, I had the privilege of meeting a guy with about 90 days sobriety in Ann Arbor, who was the person that I had done that horrible thing to back in 1963 that I was never able to talk to anybody about. And after 16 years of contended sobriety and continuous sobriety, I was granted to make my last amends through the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's just wonderful. And that sort of ties right into the sixth step. You know, I've always been entirely ready to make amends, or I've always been entirely ready to rectify the stuff in my inventory. But the problem I had with the sixth step is I was the one who was trying to remove the things. You know, it doesn't say entirely ready to have Ross remove the character defects. You know, I read it that way for years, but it says God. And sometimes I wonder why he doesn't do things faster than he does, you know. But after seeing that amends in my own personal program after 16 years, I can see where he was able to take that incident right when it was going to help the new guy in the program and help me and help the men at the meeting that we were at. He took that lousy thing that I'd done and made four or five or six people's lives better with it. And if I would have run in a few years earlier or any time in mine and tried to rectify that, I would have messed it all up. And I think the thing that the sixth step also helps is with the entirely ready part is it opens my mind to a lot of different concepts, because when I got here, I didn't believe anything you guys said or gals said. I was closed-minded to beat the band. I had a tunnel alcoholic vision, and I was going, what do they say? Self-will run riot. I was going that way through life, or tornadoing through life. And to take suggestions from other people was absolutely foreign to my behavior. And if it wasn't for these sponsors, I still wouldn't be, you know, I'm not as proud of being Ross Hansinger as I am being, I have part of Jim, and I have part of Frenchie, and I have part of Doctor, and I have part of the Judge, and I have part of all you people in me. And at different times when I get into these character defects, I can remember what you all said. And it's just wonderful. The other thing real quickly about step six is don't put off doing it. You know, postponing your problems. The ones that you can fix. And again, I'm just going to probably copy something I've already said, but I think the majority of us only have one or two or three character defects. We just keep practicing it over and over and over. It's an honor to be here, and I'm always proud to be sober and at a meeting at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ross. You touched on the importance of the inventory steps. Inventories are such an important part of my life that my wife takes them daily. Step 7, 8, and 9, would you please welcome Kush from Kalamazoo?
Hi, everybody. My name is Kush, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kush.
I'm very grateful to God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to be here with you this morning sober. Since we're all qualifying, I'm somewhere between George and Ross. I practiced since, I don't know, Charlie, how many months? One of my favorite character defects, and last night about 10:30, I did look at the 12 and 12. So I'm a little ahead of George. But I didn't rehearse, so I'm behind Ross. And I'm also not funny. So go to sleep, and we'll wake you up when you get to the good stuff in 10, 11, and 12. Also, real early on, very early on, someone, and at this point, I don't really remember who it was, because I was really still so unbelievably, you know, fog-bound. But somebody said, whatever you do, don't memorize these things, because you'll be in trouble, and you'll learn them wrong, and you'll never figure it out. So, I didn't. So I have to cheat. And Charlie called, he didn't really say this, but I think his intent, as he giggled, was I have trouble with these things. So since the last time I was on a step panel, I had 4, 5, and 6, he says, this time you get 7, 8, and 9. Step 7 is humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And I didn't do real good on that for a real long time. Had to keep going back. But I finally figured out, with your help, and the help of a lot of people who love me very much, that if I really have done a thorough and fearless four-step, that my shortcomings are all listed out for me. They're there in the four-step, and so I don't have to go hunting for them. I also learned that I don't have to sit and stew for an extended period of time on the difference between a character defect and a shortcoming. It means the same thing. It's just that Bill W. was an excellent writer, and he knows that we don't use the same word over and over and over again. Maybe that's a sign we're getting a little weller, you know, that we don't have to just keep using the same word over and over. And so I didn't, you know, have to play that game of thinking they were somehow different. But I don't think I'm unique, that I never got past the first word or had a hard time. I eventually think, maybe for a very brief moment, I've gotten past the first word of that step, just humbly asked. And it was very hard for me to humbly do anything, and I never asked. But somewhere along the line, the book or you people told me that my pride was going to get me drunk and I better get rid of it, because the pride I have when I came into this program was totally false. I think some of the pride I have today is real, and that I'm proud to be here today, because I'm proud of you and I'm proud of the gift that you were kind enough to give me. But all that false pride, all that how wonderful I am, is all in self-centered fear. That's what it's based in. That awful fear that I won't get something I want. That fear that kept me in a high chair till I was pretty darn old. I'm not as lucky as the warm fuzzies in the front row. My higher power didn't see fit to get me here at a very young age. But that's okay. It takes what it takes, and I had to do what I had to do to get here. And then the other side of that coin is that I've got something, and you're going to take it, somebody's going to take it away from me. And those two, that fear, that awful fear. And before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and working these steps, I really thought the only way that I could hang on to anything was to do it myself. The only way I could get anything was to do it myself. And when I was so broken that I could barely dress myself, and made a phone call, I was given the greatest gift if me given to a human being on the face of this earth. And that is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a loving God in my life, and sobriety. And I think that comes and begins to come in the third step when I prayed, as the big book taught me to pray, to be relieved of bondage of self, nothing more. Just get me out of the way. And in doing that, at least for that moment, is able to totally surrender. And the longer I'm around and the more I read the big book, that's really what humility is. If I'm willing on a daily basis to totally surrender and to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand Him, that I am prepared to humbly ask that my character defects be removed. And I also discovered, through your help, that remove doesn't mean erase. Took me a long time to figure that one out. Remove does not mean erase. Nowhere in Webster says remove equal erase. And it goes right back to that I have a daily reprieve from alcohol, from self-centered fear, from my defects of character, my shortcomings, providing I maintain my spiritual condition, which to me is going right back to step three on a daily basis and turning my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand Him. And because I am then surrendered and then free of the bondage of self, I am free of self-centered fear, and I can get a little bit of whatever that thing is that we call humility and mystify so much. I don't know if I've got it or not, but I know that I can hit the prayer bones in the morning and humbly ask to live a better day. And I guess I can't ask for much more than that. And that for that day, try to not live in my shortcomings. To live, it says in the book, as we approach step six, and if we've done a good fit, we can then are free to walk in the light of the Spirit and on a daily basis ask to not have to live and be ruled by my defects of character. And I guess I can't, you know, the steps were written in an order. And I do believe that they were divinely inspired. And look at them separately. So if I'm impinging on anybody's stuff, I think it's okay because I'm not going to go ahead. I'm only going to look back. Because in the fourth step, again, if I've done a good one, my eighth step has been completed for me. The chances are if I resent somebody and honestly look at my role in that resentment, their name goes on the list. Because that's really what it's about. And if I've really done the fourth step, my eighth step is completed. And like other people I've heard, again, I'm not unique. I think in the beginning I thought, well, the only person I ever really hurt, because see, I'm saner than Ross. I've never been married. Came awful close once, but boy, I took care of that fat. However, I'm crazier. Because somewhere along the line, in a total mad, probably not too sober moment, agreed to take on as being a co-parent in a single parent adoption of two children who came with medical subsidies for shrinkage. You know, it's cute. You know, if you adopt somebody in a wheelchair, the state of Michigan will buy the wheelchairs till they're 18. And it should have dawned on me when they say these guys come with medical subsidy for psychiatric care. So I'm not totally sane, just sort of sane. So it was real easy for me to say, well, the only person I hurt was myself. That's such a cop-out. I hear people say that time and time again when you're discussing the eighth step. I only have to make amends to me. I don't have to make amends to my wife. I'm doing it by example. I don't have to tell my mother all the awful things I did. You're right, you don't. She already knows. People I make amends to couldn't care less, most of them. They've forgotten. They don't have to live in the garbage and the swill of knowing what a piece of garbage I am. I do. And the eighth step is for me to make that list, to honestly admit that I have hurt these people. That I have in some way been unfair, that I use them to my own ends. Not for them. I'm not important enough for them to even remember, probably. But I have to do it for me. And yes, one of the most important people on my list is Cush. Annabelle, whatever you call me. But the only way I can make amends to Cush is by making amends to you. I can never, ever make an amend to myself without making amends to the people I have harmed in my life through my drinking and my character defects and my shortcomings and all those other good things. Just brings me to the ninth step. And the ninth step, I don't remember either. What does the ninth step say? Make direct amends. I don't memorize. Love you, Lainey. Make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. God doesn't want us to run roughshod over people in sobriety. I don't think God wanted us to do it when we were drinking. But we had to do what we had to do. But certainly, God's will for me is not to continue to run roughshod. So if an amend would harm another person, it's better that I just live with it and figure out other ways to make that right. But the majority of my amends that I had to make were ones where they were emotional hurts, where they were friends, people that loved me were watching me drink myself to death, and that hurt them. And as I gained a little more sobriety, I realized how much that hurt them, and I had to make amends. I am also the adult child of an alcoholic. There's only one of me today. I don't know why I call it children. I think there were a few others in the past, but there's only one today. And I grew up in this fellowship. I'm very, very honored today to have my dad's big book. And the date is 1942. My dad was not sober from 1942 to 1979. When he died in 1979, by the grace of God, he had 11 years of continuous sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he first came to the program in 1942. And part of my denial system was to never drink like my father. I wasn't going to be like him, no way. So he binged, I drank every day. He didn't like the taste of it, I loved it, you know. And also part of my denial system was that I would go to any lengths to get sober except Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, of course not. I knew it worked. I wasn't ready to quit drinking. My dad never saw me sober. And that bothered me. He never said anything to me either. I know today what an incredible program that man must have been able to work those last 11 years. that he never, ever said anything to me, and it must have broken his heart. I didn't know it then, but I know it today, how hard that would be for me. And I thought, boy, what do I do? And I tried to write a letter to a dead person, and that didn't work. And one of my earthly higher powers, who's in that big meeting in the sky today, and sometime before this thing ends, I hope we get a rousing right on. Jack said to me, Kirsch, the next time you go home to Pennsylvania, go to the cemetery and make your amends. And I did that. I sat on my dad's tombstone, and we talked. And it sounds kind of squirrely, but it works. And I made the amend. And I know, because of what you people have given me in this program, I know that he heard that amend, and that I have been forgiven. Not long ago, within the last year, and I thought I pretty much had done them, you know, and my list was pretty exhaustive, but there was one relationship that, by God, I was going to take no blame for. That other person did it, did everything, screwed me royally, and there was no way I was involved. Sure. And things were getting real weird, and I didn't feel right. My program wasn't working, and I couldn't do it, and my people I sponsored would come to me. I call them pigeons, by the way. You can all throw things at me. And there's a thing in Box 459 that Dr. Bob wrote, and it's a loving term. And I probably will continue to. Anyway, my pigeons were coming to me with their problems, and I was growling at them and saying, go away. You know, and I'm not a very nice sponsor. I get fired regularly, and that's fine with me. You know, they come and we have to be in touch with our feelings, right? You have to, and gyrate and get in touch. And they call up and they're devastated, right? Their chewing gum fell out of their mouth and they're absolutely devastated. And they get from this mean person, what step are you on? Well, not bad. You know, why are you doing this to me? So it's real good. I mean, if you really find that you're having trouble, it's real easy. You just say, what step are you on? And when was the last time you blew the dust off the big book? And they fire you. It's no problem. And when would you go to your last meeting? And that really cinches it. But I was being that awful person whose chewing gum fell out of her mouth and couldn't handle it. And, I was in the high chair and beating I hadn't lost touch enough, to ask for some help because something was wrong. And what is, you know, there are no coincidences. I ended up at about, six or seven, and I started going other places than places I normally go to meetings, and no matter where I went, no matter what I picked up, every book opened to the ninth step. Everybody's talking about the ninth step. You know, I go to a step meeting, it was on step one, they're talking about the ninth step. And it finally hit me right between the eyes. I had never, ever made amends in that relationship. And so I made a long-distance phone call, I got the person's address, I had to call a whole bunch of people to find out how to get in touch. And did, and made the amend, and a lovely friendship, not an intense one, but a very nice friendship, a few letters flying back and forth as a result of that. And you know what happened? Wham. I liked my pigeons again. My program was working again. I could pray again. I couldn't pray. You know, I did, no way. Get down on my knees? Hell no. And I've been getting down on my knees for a fair length of time after I finally found God, thanks to you people. And no way. I wouldn't humbly do anything. I wouldn't, and there I was in this awful grip of fear again. The faith was gone. Everything was gone. You guys told me what to do. My higher power speaks to you. And I was able to make that amend. And things were okay again. And I'm sure there are more out there that for whatever reason haven't made their way into the inventory yet. Because the only way I can figure out what those are is to go back and at least do a quickie inventory, and a real one, neon, not the day, you know, all day long. Whoops, I'm not going to do that because that's my head. Okay. But a real one. You know, I also don't believe in T-bars, you know. I think there's a list. Just like what I had, you know, what you have to do if you run a store. You just make a list, and it's mostly garbage. And for every garbage, I don't have to have a microwave special, you know. That's not why I'm taking an inventory. I don't have to find out how wonderful I am. I have to find out where I am not doing things the way God would want me to do them today. And through that, I can find peace. Through that, I can humbly ask to have those shortcomings removed. Through that, I can find out if my list is complete today. And through that, I can then turn to page 82 and 83. I don't have those memorized either, and I'm not going to read them because time is short. But 82 and 83, for those of you who haven't dusted off the big book for a long time, is the last set of promises that this program can make to us if we're willing to work it. There are two other sets that give you a little boost on the way. One set after the third step and one after the fifth. And it's not surprising that that's where they'd be, because those are the times, I think, for me, that I need that extra little boost, that extra little hope this program holds out for me on a daily basis, that I will find a new freedom, that those awful self-centered fears will be removed, that I will find and have found, and it is repeated to me every single day of my life, that God will do for me what I cannot do for myself. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you, Cush. A lot of impact on what you said as far as I'm concerned. Would you please help me welcome from Detroit, Adair, Richmond, Algonac, any place else you'd be?
Pardon?
Marysville?
Yeah.
Larry White for 10, 11, and 12.
Thank you. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Larry.
Hi, Larry.
For a long time, my address was my license plate. I'm a DCM for District 22. My third conference. I've done open talks, but not in front of this many people, and a lot of sick Al-Anon. But, you know, it's like 3 years ago I couldn't spell DCM. I've got a sponsor that got me started in service work. You know, he's taking me around. I'm doing 10th, 11th, and 12th step. 10th step continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly blame them. You know, and last night someone mentioned that, Richard mentioned that his wife takes his inventory on a regular basis. Friend of mine from my home group, Richard's from my home group. I've got another friend out there from my home group that, never any good at these things, either. What? Do I have to start this again? Well, people take my inventory on a regular basis. It started out that way. That's how I got sober, because, you know, I really didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, I just thought I drank a lot. I thought I got into trouble. I thought I had problems just getting caught. I thought, when I say blame them, it's always did. I didn't rehearse anything. I just, 3:30 this morning, I was awake. Walt was snoring. drank too much coffee. You know, made all these reasons. I was on the couch. Walt got to bed.
You know, he got back there before I did. So, but, you know, as I say, I need help with my daily inventory. I found out after about 6 months or so of being sober that, I called them my noticeably normal days. They were, no highs, no lows. You know, it was like no big startling revelation or no big, catastrophe in my life. And I just went through my day and everything just seemed to go smoothly. And I got home that night and my inventory was Jesus. Kind of normal, I guess. You know, and I always had, I never drew a line between normal and what wasn't normal. You know, normal was the way I was living. You know, people that didn't drink, they weren't normal. People that could take their families into a restaurant, bar restaurant or whatever, and eat and have a good time were not normal people. They were a bunch of fools. They were a bunch of fakers. You know, how could you possibly sit there and have two or three drinks with a wife and three kids and spend $50 on dinner and have a good time? You know, you take those people home and come back here and I'll show you a good time. But even if I blame or even if I make excuses, they always come back to me. I'm always at the base of it. I'm always the cause, right or wrong. I'm not always wrong. I found that out too. You know, as bad as I thought I was is, you know, I never really thought of myself as a bad person. I just thought, well, I just screw up a lot. You know? I used to think that I screwed up, you know, whenever a cop was around. And my sponsor enlightened me. He said, well, no, you were just screwed up all the time and a cop just happened to be there once in a while. You know, a friend of mine mentioned to me a couple weeks ago that if I can go to bed at night and go to sleep, you know, I've done okay that day. You know, and I know there's days that I don't do the best I can, and I know there's days that I can do more. I didn't rehearse. I didn't practice this. I talked to George about this before last Christmas. And here I am at 3:30 this morning going, what am I going to talk about? 3 days ago, I wasn't even ready to come here, you know. Gee, it's that time already. Where did this time go? So, you know, I've done open talks, I've written notes, and I've left them home. And I did that. I left everything home. And my sponsor would always say, you know, if you're lying, we'll cough twice. So I don't see him here, you know. So. God always gives me what I need. In the 11th step, thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. As we understand him. The key for me there is to seek. You know, it's like, it's never answered the way I want it answered. It's never answered when I want it answered. And I never know that it's being answered because I don't, you know, he never answers it the way I want it answered. And it's never quick enough. It never has been right now. You know. And there have been times when I thought this prayer stuff ain't working. You know, I had a resentment a week ago about it with a guy over a person. And all the way home, I prayed for that son of a gun. And nothing happened. You know, I went to bed angry. Woke up angry. But I was taught that you just keep doing it. You know, if it ain't working right now, just keep doing it. And believe it whether you're going to believe it or not. You know, just keep working at it. Keep doing it. Because I usually don't do that until the crunch comes, you know, until the lights are just about out. You know, when the pain gets bad enough, long enough, that's when I'll re-surrender. You know, I've done it before, it's worked before, I know it works, but I just have to wait until it gets bad enough, long enough, before I actually get down and do it. A lot of times I think I'm doing it, you know, but, I noticed it the other night when I was praying for that fool, that, I wasn't being sincere, you know. But if, you know, if I want to walk around all day long for a week or 2 weeks with it, I'll do that. I
year or so ago, I stopped and picked a friend of mine up to take him to, we were going to go and bid a job, and I was having a miserable day. And he asked me how I was feeling. I said, well, I'm miserable, and I'm upset and irritable and anxious. And he said, well, you got to work your program at work, too. See, I didn't want to hear that. So I said, no, I just got to feel this way. And I made up my mind to feel that way. I went home that night and sat on the floor. I leaned up against the couch. I just sat on the floor and kept telling myself, you're going to feel this way the rest of the night. And I did. We are what we think. We do what we think. We will be what we think, you know. But, you know, it's the answer step. I've heard it called the answer step. The answer will come. It's just I don't know when. It might be right now. I'll walk around the answer all day long and not know it's the answer. It's right there. It's always right there. I'll drive around miserable, upset, or whatever over something. The answer's right there all the time. I've got a little thing on my dashboard that God help me to remember that nothing's going to happen to me today that you and I can't handle. And, I put that there to remind me that, he's there. I don't always take advantage of that. I just don't realize it all the time. That's part of my inventory too. I appreciate it when someone like Jeannie last night jumped into my shit for 3 hours, And she's done that before. And I'll get mad, and I'll say, well, all right, yeah, I started going back to more meetings, but I didn't see you. Well, she just wasn't going to the same meetings I was going to. But it's nice to know that she cares. That's one thing I think is important. I heard a guy yesterday mention he's got the best damn home group in the whole world. There's two of them. I got one. Yeah. Three? Yeah. When I'm not around the group for a week or 2 weeks, somebody's calling. It's been that way all through my sobriety. Somebody calling. Somebody showing up. People around when I didn't want them around. It's always been that way. And I didn't realize the importance of a home group. I got to my home group through a 12-step call. The guy I sponsored, he called me one morning, and he was ready. You just know. I've had 12-step calls before where at 4 o'clock in the morning where I asked one guy one time, he called me at 4 o'clock in the morning. I said, are you drinking now? He said, no, I just finished my last one at 1 o'clock. So I took him to a meeting the next that morning at 9 o'clock, and he told me he had a 40-ouncer at 1 o'clock. And that was the end of it. I took him to one meeting, and he seemed ready for that. The meeting went a little longer than he wanted. I took him back the next day, and I picked him up anyway, and he said, will we be done by noon? I've got to meet my wife for lunch. I said, well, we'll try. But I believe that, I've had 12-step calls where I've had to sit there and think, this person's dying. I think John mentioned it last night in his talk, that I believe that today, when a person calls at 4 o'clock in the morning, there's a problem there. I've heard people say, if you're drunk, I'll call, call me back in the morning. Shit. I'm sober now, I ain't gonna call. I never called anybody when I was sober. I never asked for anybody when I was sober, 2 days after I stopped drinking, I felt better and the problem was gone. I can do this all over again. There's a quote in the AA service manual. It says, we must carry the message, else we ourselves can wither and those who haven't been given the truth may die. And that whatever the message may be, whatever the seed is, one man puts it, when the walls are high enough and thick enough, all we can do is stand outside and make sympathetic noises and hope that the data gets in. All I can do, I tried, when I got out of treatment, I tried to fix the world. I had all the answers, you know. The people that I've met that went through the center that I went through did the same thing. We all did that. And I learned early on that you tell them your story. You don't tell them how to fix this or do that. This is what happened to me. This is the way it was. This is what it's like now. You know, this is what happened to me. And that worked. I know nobody, you know, again, like Jeannie last night, I didn't want to hear what she had to tell me. You know, but thank God she was there. You know, she wouldn't have told me if she hadn't cared. There's people, I won't say a lot, there's some people that I'll tell them once, you know. I'll tell them, I wouldn't even be talking to you if I don't care. You know. I owe an awful lot to this program. It's things like these conferences and gatherings of people, you know, where two or more are gathered in his name that, really make things special in my life. I never had anything like this. You know, I dreamed about being a part of something like this. And, you know, I didn't think I had to quit drinking to do it. But, you know, that's what it took. But I needed a lot of help with that. I need help every day with somebody telling me what's wrong with me. And, you know, not step by step, letter by letter. I can deal with some of that stuff myself, but there's just times I just don't know, you know. And if you care, please tell me. You know, don't let me wander around and smash into walls and do something stupid. Ask God for help in the morning. Ask God and help an hour later. Ask God again about noon. I was thinking about a guy that at last year's conference talked about there was a meeting started up, I can't remember where it was, somewhere in the middle of the state, where he went there every week for 2 years and nobody showed up. Went there every week for 2 years and ate coffee. Nobody ever showed up. He went there every week. I know a guy that did that for quite some time. You know, they finally started coming. You know, I don't think anybody gets this program on a roll. Nobody really. You know, I think I'll join AA today. I just sold my mutual funds off. I think it's, I think I'll join AA. But I know they're coming, you know, and it's good. We got to be there, you know. We got to be there when they get there. A lot of times I went not to AA, but you know, that's what I think. I feel like I did that all my life, my drinking life. Anyway, I looked. I kept searching and hoping I would find what I wanted, and it was never there. I wasn't one to go out and try to look for happiness or find happiness. I waited for it to come to me. And it never did. You know. The worst night of my life turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. You know. The divine intervention took place without me knowing what happened. And it's worked that way every day of my life so far. If I'm willing to sit there and take a look at it, the messages are always there. The answers are always there. But I got to be willing to sit there and take a look at it. I got to be willing to sit there and listen to it. And 90% of the time, it ain't what I want to hear. You know. But if my thinking is so wonderful, what the hell am I doing in a place like this? You know. Why do I go to an AA meeting and say I don't know if my thinking is so wonderful? But it's really great to be here. It excites me to see all these ex-drunks here. Even some that I used to drink with. It's good to be here. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Larry. I think it was Cush that mentioned sobriety being a gift. To me, it is a gift. The only way that I can maintain my obligation on that gift is to work the steps in order the way they were just given to you today. Would you please help me again to thank George, Ross, Cush, and Larry? For all of those who wish to, would you please help me close this meeting with the Lord's Prayer? Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
Keep coming.
Amen.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.